Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Healthcare Du Jour is brought to you by High-Tech Answers and Healthcare Now Radio, part of the Answers Media Network, and is sponsored by the Law Offices of Myrick O'Connell. Now here is your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is Nico Skabaski, president of Redox, and in the so far short list of returning guests. So, Nico, it's great to have you back on.
Yeah, really happy to be here.
So, kind of before we dive into our main discussion today, while people will hopefully be able to kind of look into the show archive and find our previous discussion where we talked about the startup world, why don't you just give everyone a little bit more of a reminder in terms of who you are and what you do?
Sure. So, yeah, as you said, my name's Nico. I'm one of the co-founders of a company called Redox. So we founded the company about 5 years ago now, maybe four and a half or so. It's hard, time flies when you're having fun. Essentially what we do is provide data to software developers who are building applications for healthcare. And so we really see ourselves as a middle layer, a two-sided network of sorts with health systems on one side and software developers on the other side who are building these applications. And so we've been able to scale this over the past few years, and we're live at about 450 health systems now across the country, enabling really digital transformation across the entire digital health spectrum, everything from patient engagement apps to telehealth to kind of back office applications that patients may never see, but actually improve healthcare from an efficiency standpoint, for instance. That's my day job. And so, obviously something that I'm really passionate about and focused on.
So kind of, as you said, in the role in your company, you get to be kind of the, as you said, the intermediary in between the health systems and the developers. So I'd imagine that kind of lets you see firsthand a lot of the proposed new tools or proposed innovations and how those might actually be utilized.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And I think that's one of the things that really keeps me excited about where the industry is going. You know, digital health is a hot topic. And from our vantage point, we do get to see the different technologies that are being adopted. We get to see pilots turn into enterprise rollouts. We also get to see pilots die and kind of see where people don't talk about it very often, but where innovation fails in the market. And I think that's a really great vantage point to have, and something that we cherish, and being the middleman, seeing that data flow across.
So, and actually, I kind of like to pick up on what you just said about, maybe focus on, I'll call it the hopefully silver lining first of when you see a pilot not succeed, but end up kind of failing or going away. What types of solutions have you seen kind of go that way? And what lessons have you been able to glean from where, an idea might seem great, but then once you start trying to implement it, the follow through might not be as easy as once envisioned?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there are a lot of solutions out there. Well, you could probably imagine many solutions. Every time you go to the doctor, there's probably 100 things that you see that could be digitized to improve that experience. And a lot of the solutions that we've seen kind of not make it through enterprise rollout are ones that don't have a clear or easy to measure ROI. So every health system, they've been caring for patients for decades without the use of your technology. So when you bring in a new technology, it has to make significant improvement because it is costly for them to maintain. It's costly for people to think about using and train people on. And so when those costs don't outweigh the benefit, and if that benefit isn't clearly documented or clearly visible, either through time saving or revenue generated or cost saved, then we see those things not getting rolled out. And some of the challenges with that is, if a product is simply supposed to improve patient care, but we can't really measure that because, there might not be a large sample size, or it kind of intuitively improves patient care, but you can't really see it in outcomes. It's those sort of wishy-washy return on investments that are hard to that are hard to quantify. Then on the other side, if the product doesn't seamlessly kind of align with the provider's workflow, then it's hard to get adoption. And so we've seen some pilots die simply because the providers who are part of the pilot don't like using it. You know, they might try it once or twice, but they can't get it to be sticky. And therefore, you know, the health system decides not to move forward on it. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, if you think about it, what are the costs of using the product, both in terms of time and effort and dollars, and what are the benefit they receive from it? That benefit should be probably at least 2x the cost in order for a health system to really justify rolling it out.
Yeah, and your point about being able to have a quantifiable return on whether it be a confluence of the monetary investment and the improvement on processes, whether it's through identifiable improvement in patient care or an identifiable improvement in workflow. Intuitively, those sound like very common sense because mm-hmm. you feel like anytime you put a tool into place, you want to be able to see how it's helping you, and then also make sure that it fits into what you're trying to do as opposed to adding more steps.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, actually, on the flip side, there have been tools that early on we saw were kind of in that wishy-washy, you know, warm and fuzzy feelings of return on investment and not cold hard cash, for instance, but actually have gained more adoption because policy changes have influenced it. And I'll give two quick examples. So with the movement towards value-based care, you know, this slow slog that we're moving towards, I was actually just at a HIMSS meeting this morning, and the CIO of UC Health said that still 92% of their revenue comes from fee for service. So it's still a journey that we're squarely in the beginning of, but we have seen programs within value-based care that have actually driven technology adoption. So the first kind of category of that is social determinants of health. We all know that the vast majority of our lives happens outside of the healthcare setting. And that's where, you know, things like our nutrition and our behaviors and the neighborhood we live in and our access to food and things like that affect our health much more than the actual healthcare we're receiving. And with health systems now disincentivized to, around readmissions and things like that, they have to take social determinants into account more frequently. So now it's something that was an area where, you know, there wasn't real benefit aligned to it in a fee-for-service world. In a value-based care world, we have to care about social determinants of health. And so we see companies like NowPow or Healthify CityBlock really start to gain traction in the market because they can tie their benefit directly to costs that a health system would incur if a patient was readmitted or if they didn't receive the right services outside of the four walls of the healthcare setting. So we see technology adoption spurred there. We're also seeing it spurred in kind of the orthopedic space that pioneered the bundled payments models, another move towards value-based care. We're seeing new technology emerge there around coordinating care across the specialist, you know, the surgeon, the physical therapist, your primary care provider, all the clinicians involved in taking care of a knee replacement or a hip replacement, for instance, because when we pay for an episode of care rather than for each piece of it, those people have to coordinate more effectively. They have to communicate better. They have to make sure they're not being repetitive or redundant and deliver care that's not going to result in complications, which will turn a bundled payment kind of model on its head and you know, make you go in the red very quickly at a health system. So yeah, those are two kind of quick examples of technologies that didn't really have a clear ROI, but with the movement towards value-based care, we are seeing an uptick in those types of tools and technologies being adopted by health systems.
You know, and it's actually interesting with those examples you gave. It, you know, in each of those places, as you said, regulation or, you know, kind of overarching changes in the industry were driving change. And it feels like it was an opportunity for the tool to come in and from the beginning help to implement a process as everyone was trying to learn it, as opposed to layering into an established process and trying to drive change where arguably it's not necessary or it's not readily as visible that change is necessary.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and then kind of the other piece of what you're talking about, the having to be able to demonstrate and prove the value, I feel like I've been reading a bunch recently about, you know, that's kind of where the rubber meets the road. It's how do you get to that place where you get that opportunity to demonstrate the value? Because, you know, companies might be pitching to try and get into an organization so they can get that initial proof of concept, but the response is, well, tell me it works before you can come in. So, you know, do you see the difficulties of how do you get that kind of first few tests out there so the company is actually able to demonstrate and either succeed and keep going on, or, you know, as you already said, in some instances, you know, once you actually get out there live, it does turn out that maybe it doesn't work the way it was envisioned.
Yeah, this is kind of a chicken or egg problem that I think a lot of startups face when they're launching their product. And oftentimes, unfortunately, companies can end up in what we like to call pilot purgatory, where they can get pilots at health systems, but they can't really get past that pilot phase. I think there's a few things contributing to this. First off, health systems aren't, well, we don't have a mechanism for healthcare organizations to share their learnings with digital health across their organizational boundaries. So if you're a relatively new company and you've had success at one organization, bringing that into the second organization can be quite difficult because, of course, that second organization is unique. They have their unique mix of patients and providers and technology stack. And so they feel the need to pilot again. And we've worked with a lot of startups who have kind of ended up, you know, doing pilot after pilot after pilot. And of course, if you end up in pilot purgatory, your revenue isn't like, you know, you're not charging as much or if at all for these pilots. So you're not generating revenue in order to sustain the business. And it can get into a really dangerous place. So I think that the way to combat this is on that initial pilot, make sure you have a clear hypothesis for the benefits that your solution should provide. State that hypothesis clearly. This is like, you know, simple scientific method stuff. State the hypothesis clearly, and then state in the contract or at least in a handshake agreement with that organization that, okay, we're going to give us 6 months here or 3 months or however long your pilot period is. And at the end of this, if we meet the requirements or if we validate the hypothesis, then we're going to transition to a full-blown commercial contract. And that might mean enterprise rollout. It might mean, you know, something longer than the short-term pilot contract that you have in place. But that way, it allows you to transition from a pilot at that first organization, but it also allows you to have some, you know, a little bit of rigor around your, you know, your scientific process in testing out if your tool actually works. And you can often engage in the health system, especially academic health systems. If you talk about it in this way, they'll get behind it because they'll see it as an experiment. They're used to running experiments. You know, there are a bunch of scientists there who do this for a living, and we'll see it as improving the knowledge base in healthcare around, you know, their implementation of whatever digital health solution it might be. One of the challenges we've seen with this approach is that if you go too far down the rabbit hole of acting like it's an experiment, they'll often say, okay, well, we're a research organization, and therefore, if you want to run experiments with us, you know, there might be fees for that. And there have been health systems cited at actually charging startups to pilot with them rather than the other way around with, you know, them purchasing a solution to add value to their organization. So it's a slippery slope, but I think there's a sweet spot in there that we have seen some organizations navigate and kind of get through that pilot purgatory.
Yeah, no, and I think that's a great description of it. I've seen all those examples that you gave, and it's you know, as you said, sometimes it's the startup itself unintentionally getting itself in that position, especially when it starts talking about research, because, you know, as you just said, when research is thrown around, that raises different understandings of a process than if you're talking about a service contract or some other type of service vendor type relationship.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's the trick. We call it an experiment. We say hypothesis, but we don't say the R word. We don't say research, because that pulls in all the other bureaucracy that might go along with it.
Yes. And for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Nico Skavasky from Redox. And we've been talking about growth of digital health and implementation. And kind of as we were just talking about, you know, the challenge of getting a solution into usage and then into paid usage for the first time being difficult, I'd kind of like to think about digital health from a broader perspective. And over the past however many years, you know, I feel like every year you have to keep adding another one of the length of the discussion about, you know, digital health is the next great thing and it's going to be revolutionizing the healthcare industry. Kind of given everything that we've been talking about so far, where does digital health actually stand and where might it actually be on the maturity scale?
Yeah, well, I love to think of Gartner's hype curve here. And where is digital health on that? Of course, it, you know, a lot of things on the hype curve, they get overhyped at the beginning, and then they kind of go through that trough of despair, then they come out the other side. I think that we're probably heading into that trough of despair. We went through a lot of hype probably a year or two ago. We saw tons and tons of venture capital investment in early stage companies. So really early stage companies just starting out, you know, raising millions of dollars with really an idea and maybe the beginnings of a product and maybe one or two pilots, but not really the traction that was probably required to warrant such investment. So that may have been a result of us being kind of at the top of that hype cycle. You know, I say this knowing that venture capital investment is probably going to break records again this year. So maybe we're still at the top of it, but I think it's driven on the fact that healthcare is the kind of the last frontier for computers and the internet and software to disrupt. We've seen it across pretty much every other industry, and healthcare is still using paper tremendously. I was talking to a healthcare organization the other day who is a HIMSS stage 7 health IT kind of user. So that, you know, that's how HIMSS kind of categorizes. And that's the top category, you know, the most technology forward health system. And they still fax 2 million papers every single week. So they, you know, the most technology driven healthcare organizations are still faxing. So it's clear indication that there's something that needs to change within our industry. So entrepreneurs are flooding in trying to solve these problems. But one of the reasons why we're still faxing, we're still using pagers and clipboards and all the like in healthcare is that the business model is quite complex. And so, like what we were talking about earlier, with having a clear ROI is much more difficult in our space. The user of a product is very infrequently the person who actually purchases a product. And when you have that that gap between the person benefiting and the person paying, you have to be able to justify the payment for it in different ways than simply providing a good user experience. So, you know, to contrast that with consumer apps, for instance. If you can get consumers using your applications, then you can either get them to pay for it or use their data to sell ads on the platform or do these other things that can provide value on the other side of the platform. Within healthcare, because of the constituents in it, you have, you know, the patient isn't the person paying, right? We have the payer involved. Oftentimes you can't service a patient without going through the healthcare provider. So that's the health system or the hospital or the provider group. So it creates this really complex ecosystem that holds onto the status quo quite well because of the complexity. So that's why it's so difficult to penetrate this market with new technology. The stance that we kind of take at Redox is we know that this has to happen. We know that someone's going to figure it out. And we know that the easier we make it for new entrants to come into the market, for new technology to be adopted, essentially drop barriers to entry, there'll be more at-bats, right? There'll be more chances for us to try it out and to make incremental improvements at the fringes and then potentially some disruptive improvements as things get going. But I think that we're not there yet. We see all this investment go into healthcare, but we haven't really seen huge blockbuster hits as far as companies go. When Redox first started about 5 years ago, there was a cohort of companies kind of that got funding that same year. And when I look around at that cohort, there's only a few left that are still kind of relevant in the space, and none of which have kind of exploded on the scene and caused huge dramatic or disruptive change in the industry. So I think that we're, and because of that, I that's why I think we're kind of heading into that trough of despair, but hopefully we'll be coming out of it soon. And the real impact of digital health will start to be felt across our organizations in improving healthcare and providing value to patients, to providers, to really ease that provider burnout problem that's such an epidemic in the industry today.
No, I kind of taking that last point first, I agree. I hope the solutions do continue to improve because, you know, kind of going back to the part of what we were talking about earlier, you want these tools to make things easier, not to keep adding more and more steps to the actual users who would most likely are the clinicians, especially when you're talking about impact of care. But one of the things that you mentioned, which I think is a very key point, is the fact of how do you make money off of the solutions. Because as you said, in a lot of other places, you can give the end user free access, and whether or not that end user actually realizes it, you're, as you said, monetizing the data that you're getting out of it. And, you know, hopefully as people who listen to this podcast know well, when you're in the healthcare industry and you're servicing a component of the industry, whether it be a clinician or a hospital, HIPAA is certainly going to have a lot to say in terms of how you can take the data. By making it, arguably by making it more difficult for the company, it's actually aligning maybe more closely with what the end user thinks will happen in the background, which means that they're meaning that that expectation is their data is not being freely used and being the real kind of currency that they're paying with to get access to the application.
Yeah, exactly. I think that, you know, we are quite sensitive about our healthcare data in this country, and the harder it is for that data to be shared, the less useful it is. And when I say useful, I mean that in the broadest sense, both useful in the ways of actually improving your healthcare, as well as useful to the companies who are trying to make those improvements, and, you know, creating business models around them. For instance, you know, some of the challenges with interoperability that we have today are rooted in the fact that the healthcare data is predominantly kept in data centers in the basements of hospitals. Because, you know, we came from a world where data was in filing cabinets in the basements of those same hospitals, and it was just transitioned to data centers and kept in those organizations because we felt a need to keep it safe. And nowadays, you know, my assumption with electronic health records was that the point of it was so that we can utilize the data to drive insight, to do analysis, to actually look across the country and say, what are the patients like me, and figure out, you know, what worked for them and try to apply that elsewhere. We really can't do that at all today because we've kept data in these silos, because it's been perceived as being more secure and being more safe, being kept that way. And now we're kind of paying for that years later as we now have all the challenges with interoperability that, you know, has gotten national attention, and the government heavily involved in and trying to help improve.
As you said, with the government turning its attention to it, you wonder whether that could end up causing further difficulties, because if you end up with a reactionary piece of legislation or set of regulations that is responding to current complaints as opposed to trying to be fully forward-thinking and adjusting for developments in the future, you worry that that could create further barriers to getting to the eventual, you know, place where you can get the data flowing and, you know, as you said, useful for purposes of enhancing the delivery of care.
Yeah, well, and what's interesting is that in this case, I actually think that our government is quite forward thinking in how they're looking at opening up healthcare data. So they, you know, the CMS and ONC have been working together largely and put out a proposed rule to, first off, call out what is information blocking. So when is it not okay to not share healthcare data, and what sort of anti-competitive behavior are we seeing in the market that is not okay and deeming that information blocking? And then along with that, proposing penalties for doing so. So if companies are charging too much to move data around, or if they're not using standards appropriately to share that data, they'll actually get hit with fines. And at the extreme edge of that, they'll actually not be able to take Medicare patients, which is for many healthcare organizations a large proportion, if not the majority, of the healthcare that they provide. So it's very steep fines, and this is proposed rules that are still in comment period. They're still being debated over, but are expected to pull through, and we should see kind of finalized rules. The other piece of it that I think that they're being quite forward thinking on is the type of technology that is going to be mandated to be used. So the government is mandating the use of open APIs in the sense that every health system should have an API that is consistent with everyone else. So they're actually mandating the FHIR standard to be used. It's still kind of up in the air if that's going to be like which version of FHIR, but it'll be a huge step in the right direction that we'll all be using FHIR. And then furthermore, they're mandating the types of use cases, or essentially the types of authentication, how you get access to that data. And there's a couple primarily that I think are quite interesting, because there's not necessarily a lot of demand for it yet, but it's kind of taking a, if we build this, they will come mindset. So the first one being patient authorized access to applications or access to data. So this is, you know, in the technical world, it's called OAuth, but essentially when you're, you know, if you download an app on your phone and then you give that app access to your LinkedIn account or to your Facebook account, right? And it might pull down your contact information or your friends lists or, you know, your calendar, things like that. And that's essentially what is being mandated through the legislation, that you can download an app as a consumer and give it access to your medical records. So you'd call out, you know, that you have data at Kaiser and at Cleveland Clinic and at Providence, and it would go into those systems and pull out your records and pull them into that application on your phone, which is great. That's what every other kind of industry is using. The reason I say there's not that much demand for it is, you know, can you think of an app that you would do that with today as a consumer? Probably not. There's not that many apps that would utilize that data appropriately, or actually deliver a lot of value to consumers. But the mentality is, if we create the underlying infrastructure such that that's possible, it should spur a lot of innovation from you know, the entrepreneurial community and developers out there to make applications that could utilize that technology. You know, it's definitely a bet that the government is taking. But that's why I say they're kind of forward thinking, because, you know, we don't expect our government to make bets like that. They're really mandating an infrastructure that we see in other industries and hoping that those killer apps will eventually come in healthcare.
No, I think that is a very helpful and you know, insightful assessment of where the government is going, and certainly a good reminder why, you know, it's very important to pay attention to and participate in the regulatory process. But unfortunately, already, believe it or not, we're already out of time. I want to thank my guest, Niko Skvaski, for another great conversation.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's always a pleasure chatting with you.
And thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at hashtag HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.